Your gift of $18 or more to Save America Ministries will put it in your hands. Just give us a call, 1-800-SAVE-USA. We also have these wonderful Jewish calendars. They're going quickly. Make sure you get yours. $13 plus $5 postage and handling. You'll have to call us for that, 1-800-SAVE-USA, or write us a check. And can I urge you also, and I'm so grateful for those who have responded faithfully with your gifts. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. I think it's appropriate. Let's pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Jeff Kirschmeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our...
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, hopefully, they're going to be the views of Mr. William Deere. And Mr. Deere has a fascinating story, which I'm really looking forward to. Mr. Deere is an investigator. He's a professional detective. And for many years, he has investigated the death of Nicole Simpson and Fred Coleman, and basically what really happened. It's the story of O.J. Simpson. Was O.J. Simpson guilty? I mean, I have known for a long period of time that certainly 99% of the black people in this country think that O.J. was set up. 99% of the white people in this country believe that O.J. was guilty of sin. And this has created a real racial divide in our country, and I believe it was intended to do exactly that. Initially, after, of course, Nicole and Fred Goldman were found dead, why, of course, Time magazine ran a picture of O.J. Simpson on the front page. But they intentionally darkened his skin so he would look very, very black. And they know how to create images in your mind. O.J. Simpson is a black, black man who killed a white, white woman. And you know what that means. Well, basically, this was all about a racial divide. At least this is what the initial appearance of it, and race was brought up repeatedly during the trial. And since there was a majority of blacks on the jury, and of course they found O.J. innocent, why obviously this was a fixed decision. But the question is, what really happened? Well, Mr. Deere, who's with us this evening, has spent a great deal of time investigating the O.J. Simpson affair. And Mr. Deere, why did you go ahead and get started investigating? This is a long time ago, and you've been at it for a long time trying to find out what really happened. Why did you take on the case?
Well, it's been 16 years this year. On June 12th, naturally, we all on the next day heard about the murders, and based on the evidence that they were presenting in both the newspaper and on television, as an investigator, I know better, but I assumed that he was guilty because of the so-called domestic problems that he'd had, and then later on, the fact that on the 17th of June, I was the guest speaker for the International Council of Investigative Reporters and Editors, like Newsweek and Primetime, and I was speaking on homicide. And during the break, somebody asked me what I thought about the car chase scene that was going on at that time in Los Angeles involving O.J. Simpson. And I readily spoke up and said, well, it's something concocted by his lawyers, and it will go on for hours and hours and be all over the country, and he'll use that as a defense where he could not get a fair trial. Well, my son was with me, and he knows that I know better than to make statements like that, because I teach you never assume and you always verify. So as soon as I'd made the statement, my son looked up to me and he said, "You're assuming that O.J. Simpson's guilty." And I said, "Well, based on what they presented and everything else, it looks like it to me." He said, "You're assuming again." And I said, "All right, I'll tell you what I'll do. In a week from now, I'll fly out there." So that'll make it within 2 weeks of the murder. "And I'll take a look, and then I'll make that decision, because you're absolutely right. I assumed he was guilty based on what I've read and what I heard, and not based on the facts that I could then uncover."
So, all right, fine. But, of course, the story that you uncovered is an incredible one, and we'll be covering this during this next hour. What really happened that fateful night? And, of course, does O.J. Simpson know? Well, according to Mr. Deere, he does know what happened. But fascinating story. Well, you go ahead and pick up the story right there.
All right. So I flew out to Los Angeles with one of my men who'd been with me for many, many years, who also assumed that O.J. was guilty. We arrived at the intersection of Bundy and Dorothy Street, and I had him drop me off. This was the approximate time that they felt that the murders occurred on a Sunday night. So I got out of the car, and I told Chris, I said, "If anything goes wrong, you just, you know, try and get me out of jail or get me a lawyer." As a result, I walked down Dorothy Street after walking in front of Bundy where the crime scene was and came around the alleyway. I then looked in the back and then realized that on the night of June 12th, that suspect, either O.J. or whoever it was, had to enter from the alleyway and enter through the back gate. Well, when I first looked at it, the police department had put signs that said, and tape, "Do not enter crime scene." And they pushed a number of large plants up against the back walkway entrance to the area leading from the back all the way to the front door. Yes, I climbed over the back gate. I walked that walkway, and I tried, as I've done many times in the many, many murder cases I've worked over 40 years, to try and feel what it was like as the killer came through that back gate.
Well, why couldn't he have come through the front gate?
Because of the fact that the front gate was locked, and not only that, in Los Angeles, you don't let people in at that time of night unless you know who they are. So that meant somebody did not come in the front gate, had to come in the back, and had to know either how to get in or, in fact, climbed over the back gate. But when you finally walked that walkway, and it was quite a lengthy walkway, and up the steps and down the steps, and next thing you know, you're at the front door. And as I'm standing there, there's a picture window to the right, which meant that Nicole could have seen who the person was that either knocked on the door or was standing there. As I'm also standing there, I'm looking, and I see the blood on the walkway there in the steps. And I look over, and a few feet from there is where Ron Goldman's body had been found. So I realized in my mind at that time that Nicole Simpson had to know who her assailant was. Well, I then looked at it, sat down, thought about it, and realized in my mind that based on what the facts were, that O.J. Simpson could not have committed the murder, but would have had to have been at the crime scene because of the evidence that was found. Now, Nicole, prosecutor, Marsha Clark, claimed that the Bronco was full of blood, and I was able to prove it was not full of blood, that there was less than the amount of blood coming that would have been placed on, say, my thumb nail, that there was no blood on the brake and no blood on the accelerator.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Mr. Deere, actually, about 2 weeks after the murder, I actually went to the crime scene, climbed over the gate. He wasn't supposed to do that, but he went in, walked down the walk, went up the front stairs, thought about it, and came to the conclusion that O.J. probably couldn't have done it, but he may very well have been at the crime scene, and that he knew who had, we'll get into what his relationship was with the murderer, but certainly that Nicole Simpson would not have let anybody into the house unless he had known who they were. And they had to come over the back gate because, of course, the front gate was locked. So pick up the story there.
All right. Once I realized that there was no blood on the Broncos brake and the accelerator, I realized that that was impossible. You could not fight a person such as Ron Goldman, who knew karate, who sustained 27 stab wounds, and whose feet were in the dirt. So once blood mixes with dirt, it enters the soles of your shoes. So that meant that the assailant, whoever it was, had to then be using the brake and accelerator. Well, we know that O.J. was seen at the intersection of San Vicente and Bundy by a lady by the name of Jill Shively. So we know that he was coming from that area, headed toward his house. Well, that makes it look like he's guilty. But when you realize that the fact that he had no blood on the brake and no blood on the accelerator, how do you account for that? When you find just a few spots of blood that's inside the Bronco, and then once they got to the crime scene, they determined that Mark Furman climbed over the back gate, he saw several spots of blood. And then there were several drops of blood just inside the foyer. But when you walked up the carpeted staircase, and you entered the bedroom, there was no blood on the staircase and no blood in the bedroom.
Now you're talking about at OJ's home.
At his home.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, but what the police then determined later, where there was a pair of socks that was lying at the foot of the bed. But that was the only sign of blood. They cut the pipes. They took the dirty clothes. They took the washer and dryer, and they checked everything, and they found no indication of blood. If O.J. Simpson had been fighting with Ron Goldman, the type of wounds that Mr. Goldman sustained, there would have been blood in O.J.'s hair, all over his face, all over his clothes, and certainly would not have been easy to remove in time to get into the limousine to take the ride in the limousine to the airport and then going on over to Chicago. Now, what's strange is this, in the years that have come in this, and I'm trying to go through this very quickly, realizing that I've been in this 16 years, the pair of socks to me were a really striking piece of evidence because the socks contained blood from the coal and from O.J. Simpson. Well, how did it get there? Well, once we were able to talk to experts, we found that the blood from the coal and the blood from O.J. contained EDTA, which is a preservative.
In other words, it had been planted.
Absolutely. The drops of blood were planted on the socks. Now, how do we know that? Because the socks, the blood went from side to side, which means there was no foot in it. So those socks had to be taken out of the clothes hamper and blood drops placed onto the socks. Now, there's two top experts in the world that the FBI uses, and they've admitted that to me. Sano Paritis, the jail nurse, told me personally. He said, Mr. Deere, I drew 8 cc's of blood when O.J. was brought in. I placed it into a cap, purple cap, into a vial that contained EDTA. I shook it up, and the detective in charge asked for it. When he returned that vial of blood to the property room later that afternoon, instead of the 8 cc's, it contained 6.5.
In other words, basically, they set out to frame O.J.
Well, at that point, the evidence all looked like it was O.J., and I think that it's possible that certain people looked at it like, we don't want to lose this case on a basis of improper search and seizure.
But that's dishonest, and if you can't trust the police, who can you trust?
Absolutely, and you have to keep this in mind. I've been inducted in the Police Officers Hall of Fame as a private investigator for my work on numerous murder cases, and particularly the Dean Milo case up in Akron, Ohio. So I'm there looking at this thing in the proper perspective. Now, I wrote a book that came out in 2000, and 2001, I believe it was, that I said O.J.'s guilty but not of murder. And what I meant by that was that O.J. Simpson went to the crime scene because he received a phone call. That's according to my investigation, and I'm not able to prove that the phone call originated. But I do know from looking at the facts, that's a good possibility of what happened. That suspect called him and told him what had happened. O.J. then told him to get out of there. O.J. thinking that the suspect had been in a mental institution. He suffers from rage disorder. He's bipolar. He'd been quit taking his medication prior to the murders. He checked into Cedars-Sinai Hospital just weeks prior to the murders where he indicated, I'm out of my medication, I'm about to rage. Marsha Clark and the other team members on the prosecution called this a rage killing by an amateur. That same subject that we're discussing tonight, whom I consider my major suspect in this case, had been on probation and was on probation at the time of the murders on June 12th for another year to be on probation for allegedly assaulting his previous employer with a knife. Now, when I spent a number of years in this case, I wanted it over, so I also felt that I had a lot of good facts, but a lot of good theory, and I needed the facts, so I wrote this book and I published it. As a result of the book coming out, I received two special phone calls. One came from an employer of our suspect who said that when he heard about the murders, he had his staff forward over to him, because he's a silent partner, a copy of the time card, and the time card had been altered. In other words, it had been replaced by a new time card. 8 hours in, 8 hours out, except we know that our suspect left an hour and a half prior to the murders. We also know that the restaurant our suspect was working at was Jackson's Restaurant at 8908 Beverly Boulevard in Beverly Hills, who only contained and could hold occupancy of 88 people. According to this individual, he was cooking in front of 200 people. Well, that was impossible because that restaurant does not hold 200 people, and certainly not on a Sunday night. We located a man who was the head waiter at the time, who confided in me that our suspect left an hour and a half, an hour and 20 minutes, prior to the murders of Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman, and he was mad, and he was upset, to the point that he had his girlfriend there to pick him up in his Jeep, and she was crying. We know that our suspect suffers from not only the rage disorder, but has abused alcohol and drugs in the past. We know that he's been under a doctor's care. So those things pointed to me a great deal of needing deeper investigation.
Well, now, why in heaven's name would he have called O.J. Simpson? Was he a friend of O.J. Simpson's? Why would he have even been over at Nicole's home?
Well, we'll think about that in a moment, and I'll be glad to share that with you. Now, because my book coming out, I received the information and was given a copy of the time card that had been altered. Then another phone call came in, and it said this: I have what I think you need. And I said, what is it I need? I have your suspect's diaries. And I said, you're kidding. He said, no, I'm not kidding. He said, in one aspect of the diary, he writes, it's the year of the knife for me. I'm tired of being Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I cut away my problems with a knife. I had said in my first book that this individual suffered from a rage disorder, and in my opinion, had a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality. In his own diaries, that's what he said. In the same box that had been placed in the storage facility were the diaries. At the bottom of the box was a knife. Keeping in mind that they thought it was one or possibly two knives, if it was one knife, it had to be a double-bladed knife. Well, when you take a double-bladed knife and you sharpen it on a number of occasions, neither one side are going to be exactly alike. So the wounds that were on Nicole Simpson were indicative of the knife that was at the bottom of this box. In it was a sheet, and on it was the initials of our suspect. Now, that shocked me. But in addition, our suspect had put into a storage facility one fairly middle-sized box that contained his diaries, numerous photographs of him, O.J. Simpson, Nicole, but one picture stood out above all others. And there it was, this suspect in bed with his dog wearing what appeared to be the nip cap that was found at the crime scene. We blew this picture up, and sure enough, based on what we could determine, the nip cap that he was wearing just prior to the murders was the same nip cap found at the crime scene. Now, we then took the knife that was found inside this storage box, and then we compared the hilt of the knife. This knife was a replica of a Gerber Mark V, which was designed to cut and to kill, a double-bladed knife. But on the top, the piece had been removed. It left a jagged piece section at the top, which had been filled with a plastic or some sort of I forget what exact it was inside.
Some when sort we, of epoxy, perhaps?
Epoxy, yes. That's the word I was looking for. When we took this knife, we took it to one of the top experts in the medical examiner business, Dr. Vincent DeMille, who examined this knife and said this knife is designed for one purpose, that's to cut and to kill. And he then compared the hilt of the knife and the markings on the top of the knife with the wounds on Nicole Simpson's top of her head, and it matched.
All right, fine. Well, certainly you're building an excellent case with a great deal of evidence about this, but you're going to tell us, I'm sure, the relationship between O.J. Simpson and certainly Nicole. O.J., did O.J. put this man up to doing this crime, do you think?
No, he did not. I think he was protecting someone that he felt he was obligated to protect.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment here with Mr. William Deere. He's a professional detective. He's been working on this case for a long time. Go right ahead.
Our suspect was at the time 24 years old, 5'11", 235 pounds, and was a sous chef. And he carried his knives home after work.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 316 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
This man, and certainly this would be very possible even at the present time, to compare those hairs in the knit cap by getting copies of this man's hair or his DNA. Well, go ahead with this story, because I'm curious as to the relationship between this man and O.J. and why O.J. would spend everything he had. He spent his entire fortune defending himself from a charge that certainly he obviously wasn't guilty of.
That's true, but once he left that crime scene, he became part of the crime. But let me tell you this. We filed under the Freedom of Information Act last year a request to examine the knit cap so that we could compare the hair follicles with our suspects and the hair from the dog. We were told, and we have the letter to prove it from the district attorney, that stated, we have the photographs from the crime scene, but we are unable to locate the knit cap and the glove. But should and when we do, we will inform you and make arrangements for you to, in fact, see the evidence. Well, 5 minutes later, still, I wrote again and received no response. But
do you think that they are intentionally withholding that information? I mean, because obviously they did everything they could to frame O.J. They did leave his blood around, and they did contaminate his socks, and we'd had that information from others. So we know that they were trying to frame him. Do you think they're withholding the information from you?
Well, this is what's surprising. A few months ago, the Los Angeles Police Department held a homicide convention where they were hosting other homicide detectives from other departments. One in the display case contained at this hotel was the knit cap and the glove that they claimed they could not find. We photographed it for the cameraman to prove that they had lied to me, they had withheld this information, and never once offered it into evidence for us to examine with experts. So to me, that speaks for itself, right there. Now, again, you probably want to know who my suspect really is. Why would O.J. Simpson go this far, in answer to your question, to protect someone where he lost? Well, look at this. He's in prison right now. We know, and I'm telling you this, I've never met O.J. Simpson and really don't care to meet him one way or the other. But the case that he was tried on in Las Vegas, we know in our mind, based on certain evidence we've uncovered, that it was a setup, and that this individual who set him up was paid nearly $220,000 to set him up.
Well, okay. I've always believed that, obviously. You know, the guy that was carrying the gun, who talked O.J. into going down there, he wasn't prosecuted, and because O.J. went down there with a man he thought was his friend, and his friend pulled the gun, and then, of course, O.J. goes to prison. Come on now. Obviously, this was a setup. They knew exactly what they're doing, which just goes to show you, ladies and gentlemen, anybody you think is your friend, you better be very, very careful, because he could very well be an informant or somebody there to entrap you. But go ahead.
Well, the individual who set him up had been arrested a number of times, had been in prison, had even been an escaped prisoner. Yet this man set O.J. Simpson up to come to that hotel room and knew full well what memorabilia was going to be there, taunted O.J. Simpson, and he fell for it. So once he did, can you imagine, O.J.'s never been convicted of a crime, but he gets 33 years and the rest of them walk free? That doesn't make sense. The man who set up the crime made money off of it and did not go to jail.
But who put up the money? That is the question. There's big money. There was a very conscious effort. And I'll tell you, the black people across America believe O.J. was set up, and I believe he was, but go ahead.
Well, there's a lot of white people who believe that he was set up, too. But again, keep in mind the one thing that's also important. O.J. has known all along who committed the crime. So we can blame the police department. We can blame the officers. And there's a lot of good officers who would not do that. But there are certain ones, naturally, that would bend the law when they felt that O.J. Simpson was guilty. Well, in this case, O.J. Simpson, in my mind, I've just finished my new book that's titled O.J.'s Innocent, and I can prove it, and I'll challenge anybody. Because my suspect in this case is O.J.'s son from his first marriage, Jason Simpson, who was 24 years old, 5'11", 235, again on probation, been in a mental institution, suffered rage disorder, was bipolar, and admits in his own diary, it's the year of the knife for me. I cut away my problems with a knife, and I'm tired of being Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. And keep one other thing in mind. At Beverly Boulevard, where he was working that night, he was expecting Nicole Simpson and Justin and Sydney, his dad, and the party that had been at the recital. And she never showed up.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Dr. Stan here, and our guest, of course, is William Deere, and a fascinating story. And certainly, you never actually tried to contact O.J. to get his impression of this at all?
No, I did not. I mean, he's gone to a great deal, in my opinion, if I'm correct, and I feel I am, that I've been doing this a long time, and I've even, just between your audience and myself, and it's in my new book, we tried to meet with the district attorney, we tried to meet with the attorney general's office during our ongoing investigation, and did not receive any invitation whatsoever. In fact, we were denied until last year, when all of a sudden we received an invitation to meet with the investigators from the attorney general's crime enforcement agency. And it was divulged to them, and I will tell you that they were shocked. They now decided that since O.J. Simpson, we assume that, was found guilty in Las Vegas, they're going to consider the case closed. But that's not what they said to us in that meeting. They all were just excited. I think there was 8 people in the room, and they looked at it like they could not believe it.
Well, do you think that there will eventually be another trial in this case?
I do. I haven't spent 16 years of my life on my money to do this if I did not really believe in what I was doing. I believe that O.J. Simpson is innocent. I believe that justice needs to be... I truly believe that in this country we're entitled to protection. And I think that in this case, O.J. Simpson has himself to blame. But we are also to blame because the system failed. And I don't want that system to fail, and I don't want somebody else to die.
Well, of course, the thing is that as far as O.J. is concerned, he was exonerated. The jury did not buy the case, and certainly I think that Marcia Clark, though I could never understand why she would ask O.J. to put on those gloves, because, of course, that was what lost the case. If the gloves don't fit, you got to acquit. We'll be right back. Hey, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, our guest is William Deere. And before we go on, William, do you have a website? How can people get your book?
Yes, the book should be coming out, I think, sometime in January, but they can go on my webpage now. We have, the film has just been completed. They can go on to BillDeere.com or WilliamDeere.com. And look at the film, or they can look at the book when it comes out. I think that your audience, along with many others, are going to be shocked when they see the photographs. They're going to see the documentation. This is not what the first book was. This is not just a book of theory. This is a book of facts. 95% of the items that are in this book are facts. And that's that's to me a strong, strong case in anybody's language, especially since I've been doing it for nearly 40-some-odd years.
Well, now, what about the DVD? Does that have a lot of the same information in it?
Yes, it has the same information that's going to be contained in the book, and that's available. I think we did a joint venture with a Canadian firm who became very excited over this, and so we did this film, and it can be viewed on your computer by paying a fee. I think it's a nominal fee, but they were excited over this, and we're excited over this, and we're excited over the fact that, you know, that I'm able to say without any hesitation whatsoever, O.J.'s innocent, and I can prove it.
Well, you know, basically, I had the hardest time actually tracking you down. I looked all over the Internet, and fortunately, we were able to track you down. Somebody had sent me, I think it was the lead or a part of your DVD, and then, of course, I didn't have time to look at it, and then, of course, I wanted to track it down. Then I wanted to find how you were and how to get in touch with you, and I had a terrible time. Well, and I couldn't help but wonder if there might be some, well, maybe it was just by accident, but I have you had really good exposure for this? My feeling is that the people are having a hard time really getting your information.
We have had a hard time with this, but I think that when the new book is out, I think that, you know, everybody kind of believes that O.J. Simpson's guilty, but I will tell you this. About 3 years ago, Dr. Henry Lee had a symposium, and I was invited as the guest speaker, and I was given 90 minutes. And at this symposium was, I think, 633 people, and they were from all walks of law enforcement, prosecutors, criminal justice majors, all those. And so I got up and I said, ladies and gentlemen, how many of you believe in this room O.J. Simpson's guilty? And every hand was raised. 90 minutes later when I finished, I asked the same question, and only three hands went up. And one of them, when I asked him, I said, why is it out of all these people, you three believe that O.J. Simpson's guilty? And the comment was, why didn't you turn all this over to the police department? Then I would have voted that he was not guilty. And I said, because I tried. And the man said to me, are you telling me they would not meet with you? And I said, certainly, I could document it. And I flashed up on the screen the letters where we attempted to meet with the attorney general, attempted to meet with the detectives, and they refused to do so.
And then I suppose, did you ask those three people again? It doesn't really matter, but anyway, it's a shocking and frightening story, you know, that something justice can be misused in this country. Well, we've got Lauren calling from Spokane. Do you mind taking her caller?
No, that'd be fine.
All right, fine. Hi, Lauren, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing fine. Do you have a question for Mr. Deere?
Well, mostly a comment. It's kind of amazing, you know, how somebody else finally has mentioned that it was his son. Because I've been saying that for years, ever since I heard the result from the test report. The blood test from the blood that was found at the crime scene
from
the third individual. 129 million times more likely to be the blood of a close first blood male relative of O.J. Simpson.
Firstborn, he's absolutely right, yeah.
What is that? That is fathers, brothers, and sons.
Right, right.
Father is deceased at the time of the crime. Didn't he have a brother?
There was two children by Arnell. Excuse me.
Did not have a brother.
And it was Jason and then Arnell and then Justin and Sidney by Nicole. But I will tell you an answer to what you just said. Dan Rather called me after he retired, and he got a chance to look at the film. And he said, Mr. Deere, I want to tell you it's the finest investigation I've ever seen. I told CBS right up front that I felt the son did it, and they wouldn't believe me. But he said, it sure is convincing now.
Yeah, well, like I said, when I heard the test result, I knew, you know, because his father was deceased at the time of the crime. And like I said, didn't O.J. have a brother?
Yeah, I believe he did. I
was pretty sure he did, and that he was also deceased at the time of the crime. So
right, his father died, believe it or not, father died supposedly of AIDS.
Okay,
yeah,
well, fine.
That's okay, that's what I heard, yeah.
Thanks
okay.
very much for calling in, Lauren. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I'll have to admit, I never even thought of this aspect of it that Lauren brought up, that the similarity of blood certainly would be very, 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 very close.
Absolutely. It was brought out in some testimony on a previous case, you know, how close it is, and especially on their firstborn son.
Right, and of course the thing is that this really, I don't know how much money that O.J. put out of his own money. Now, apparently, do we know really, is it conjecture that the son called him and told him what he'd done? What are your thoughts on that? Well, I mean, why would you conjecture that the son had called and told O.J. and he had to go there to see?
Well, you have to understand that O.J. Simpson visited him when he was in the psychiatric unit. We have the medical records. And that Jason suffered from bipolar, but also from this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde persona, and that a lot of times he does not remember things that he did. So O.J. at that time probably thought that he was hallucinating, but he needed to know. These were his two children up there, Justin and Sydney. So when he, you know, told him to get out of there, then he knew that he had to go over there himself and make sure. And when he did, now imagine this, so stop and think about this. He's driving over there. He's in a hurry. He realized that he has to catch that plane. If what he has just been told is accurate, he will be considered the major suspect. So he has to get that ride to the airport and get on that plane before the bodies would be found, if in fact it was true. When O.J. then climbed into the Bronco, he pulled around the back. He had on the gloves. He had on the Bruno Magni shoes. He walked the walkway. And when he got up there, he realized how dark it was. But then all of a sudden, he sees Nicole Simpson lying in a fetal position. So he pulls off one of the gloves and bends down once he realized that there's nobody else around. The kids must be asleep. But here's the one kicker that nobody has ever said. On the recital, Sydney was going to have a sleepover. O.J. knew that she was going to have a sleepover when he left that recital. But he did not know that the sleepover had been canceled. But yet, according to the prosecutors, that he was planning this premeditated murder. And the timeline and everything else would have been so short. But where did the bloody clothes go? But once he bent down and he took that glove off and he reached down to check Nicole, who was lying there, and he does, and all of a sudden her head goes in one direction and the body the other, he drops it and she rolls down two more steps. And as he does, he's shocked. I don't care if you're a policeman or anybody else, if you did that and you looked around and her eyes are wide open staring at you, and then when you look up, there's a body, another one, Ron Goldman, lying against the fence, blood everywhere, and his eyes wide open looking at you. That'd scare anybody to death, especially because of the fact there was still a love-hate relationship between Nicole and O.J., and it was proven that when she had a cold, just 2 weeks prior to that, it was O.J. Simpson who came over and brought her some soup and fed her soup. But also keep in mind that on the night of this murder, when our suspect, if he went over there and he was suffering his rage disorder and he confronted her and she made the statement, you're no longer my son, I don't have to account to you for anything, and if she slapped him, which we know that she does that because she slapped the maid, that would send him off into this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde persona.
But
and when that took over, look out.
Basically, of course, she had some DNA under her fingernails that certainly was not O.J.'s.
That's correct.
And I wonder if they still have that as well. I suspect they do. Well, anyway, you mentioned Henry Lee. Certainly, he's a well-known crime investigator, and certainly he must agree with your assumptions, because I know he was called in as a consultant on that case.
That's true. Henry has invited me two other times to bring my scenario and all my evidence to his classroom, and very well received both at the symposium and in his classroom with Dr. Al Harper.
Well, I think it's amazing, of course, that the mass media in America, obviously, your story is out there, but nobody seems to be picking it up, and I have to ask why. Well, let's go to Barbara here. Barbara, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. It's a fascinating program. But I heard maybe twice on the news that Nicole was somehow involved with taking drugs and involved in some kind of a drug ring, and that there had been threats made against her.
Her and Faye Resnick had done some drugs together. There's no doubt about it, according to Faye Resnick. But Faye Resnick extended that into some personal things that happened between her and Nicole. But as far as any threats, we could find none. We could find no indication she owed any drug dealers. We could not find any indication that she had received any threats or intimidations. We do know this, that when she lived on Gretna Green, the one street behind Buttonsie, that on one night, Nicole picked up the phone and called Ron Schiff, who was a Los Angeles police department, a friend of hers and OJ's, and said, "Ron, come over here. OJ is stalking me." So when Ron Schiff arrived, according to Ron, he said, "I looked around, I didn't see it, and I went to the door and I came inside," and she said, "You know, the more I think about it, it wasn't OJ. It was Jason."
Oh, well, isn't that interesting? Anything else, Barbara?
No, it was just very interesting. So then that was probably just an, you know, whatever it was an incidental thing, and has had absolutely nothing to do with what happened at all.
Well, those, you know, sometimes you have those rumors come up, and we certainly heard them.
Yeah.
And we tried to check them because I try to be completely fair. I you know, it's what I've been doing this for a long time. I was in charge of exhuming the body of Lee Harvey Oswald. I've been inducted in the Police Officer Hall of Fame as a private investigator, so I've worked very closely with law enforcement, and I do know that sometimes mistakes are made. In this case, I think a gross mistake was made, and as a result, they were out to get O.J. Simpson one way or the other, and this Las Vegas thing just was the right thing that was a setup, and the man who set it up made the money.
And but I'd like to know who paid the money. Do you have any idea?
Yes, I do, and it will be in my new book.
Well, now I've got to buy the new book. Anyway, God bless. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Henry, who's calling from New England. Hi, Henry. And once again, our number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Henry. How are you doing?
Yeah, how you doing? Okay, I have a kind of bad reception, but I heard what's going on with the whole thing with O.J. First of all, what is your guest's name again?
His name is William Deere, D-E-A-R.
D-E-A-R. All right, and he has a website or a book or a website?
Yes, he has a website. He has a DVD.
Right, what's the name of the website?
One book, and he has a new one coming out in January.
All right, but what's the name of the website?
It's BillDeere.com or WilliamDeere.com. You can pull up my webpage there.
All right, but it's more Bill Deere. Okay, I just want to make sure I write that down. All right, here's the thing I was going to ask you with the O.J. thing. All right, so basically, who killed, was it, because, see, what I heard, too, was, there was a woman, I mean, I'm sure you know what the catastrophe with California anyway, all the illegal aliens and the drugs and everything, I mean, even in the 80s. But there was a woman who lived next door who said that she saw four men. Only one of them looked darker skinned, like could be black or something, but it was too short for OJ. And the other three were either white or Hispanic. They had ski masks on. Approximately at the approximate time when Nicole and Goldman were being killed, and they were running and jumping over the fence. And also, she said before that, I think just before that, instance, she saw them talking to them or something
that. Let's get Mr. Deere's response, because basically there's so many stories out there.
Well, let me tell you, that story turned out to be totally false.
Okay.
We checked that very thoroughly. We even had a call that came in, according to one of the newspapers reporting a double homicide on Bundy Drive. Well, that turned out to be false also. But stories, they continued and continued and continued on, and still to this very day.
Okay.
Let me ask this, though. Wasn't there more than one person at that killing? I mean,
there would have been O.J. Simpson, who would have come to the crime scene after the murders.
Okay.
And then the individual who we believe should be considered our major suspect, who we feel, in all probability, committed the murders.
Who was it?
Well, that's what we've been talking about. It was OJ's son, Jason. Okay, and so, but you,
well,
you have
you
to listen to the whole
that
program, and let's go to Tom calling calling from, from Spokane. Hi, Tom.
Yes, sir. It's good to talk to you, gentlemen. I'm up here in Northeast Washington. It's been a few years I've been listening to your program, and I have to say I appreciate the honesty and the integrity you gentlemen bring to the table. I wasn't listening to talk radio when Mark Furman, I was trying to get around the subject. I think this OJ thing, I think we're beating an old horse to death, but I have to commend you on your honesty and integrity in reporting the truth, and I look forward to every program. I'm not a big fan of Mark Furman. He was local here. In fact, Dr. Stan, you and I butted heads over the Randy Weaver issue. But I do have to say I appreciate your honesty and integrity, and keep up the good work you do. And you mentioned weapons of mass destruction. I'm afraid we're going down old trails here. But you're doing the right thing by explaining to people that things aren't always as they appear, and I commend you for that. God bless you.
Thanks very much. Good night, Tom.
All right.
Bye bye. Okay, well, certainly I'm really excited to hear your story. And, of course, what I'm even more amazed at, of course, we have our ear to the ground. Try to be on top of everything. Pretty hard to do that, but we have a lot of people feeding us information. And yet, of course, it was just one reference that somebody had sent me, one email, that actually had even suggested that there was another side to this story that we'd never heard of before. And the fact that this has not been picked up by the major media is a reflection of the degree of control that exists over what the American people think, because I think there's some people who would like us to believe that O.J. is guilty, even though certainly I think you've demonstrated very clearly that he is an innocent man.
Well, I've been doing this, like I said, a long, long time. I do not represent criminals, but I also know that when an injustice has occurred, then to me, and I'm involved, I need to do something about it. And I've tried to do just that. I've spent 16 years of my life, and it's all my money, and certainly I'm not going to make it back. So if anybody thinks I'm in it for a profit, they're sadly mistaken. But I'm proud of the work I've done on this. I'm proud of the fact that I was able to do it. And I hope that they'll give me that opportunity to judge me only on the fact I've read it, I've looked at it, and I make up my own mind, and I'm my judge, and I am my jury.
What's Jason doing at the present time?
He's living down near his father, father's old home down near Homestead. By the way, believe it or not, it's kind of a circular pattern. I started off as a policeman when I was 18 years old in Miami, Florida, and my beat was where O.J. Simpson, his residence, is located.
I see. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. What are your thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners out across America tonight?
Well, I want people to, even though this may be a, like somebody just said a moment ago, an old horse.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-dry guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. and there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
Were written before on O.J. We have a four-tape set on O.J. Simpson. Fascinating information confirms somewhat of the fact that O.J. was framed. The police framed him. They did it intentionally and purposely. One of the people we of course interviewed said why they framed a guilty man. They framed a guilty man. In other words, he thought he was guilty, but there was no question they framed him. Ladies and gentlemen, the police can frame people, and they are not punished. And Mark Furman has never been punished for his involvement. Then of course, the whole system begins to break down. And that's really, I think, one reason why nobody wants to hear Mr. Deere's story. And I will tell you, it's very, very tough to track this down. Hopefully we made it easy for you. Hope you'll want to be hearing and listening as we develop these stories more, and certainly we'll be carrying the book when it comes out. And we may even want to go ahead and carry that DVD because we'd like to get the information out. Well, Chris, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is certainly listener-supported, and I will tell you quite frankly, I've been having some real problems recently. We have over 60 outlets every week, but a lot of our listeners are having real financial problems. So if you were in a position to step forward and take their place, we'd appreciate hearing from you because we want to maintain the network that we have to try to bring people the news behind the news, the story behind the story. So if you'd like to contact my ministry, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I also want to mention that we do carry we are having an all-day seminar. It's going to be on the 17th of October, and we're bringing in speakers from across the country. It's going to be a great time. We're serving lunch. You're going to have reservations. Hope you can come. We've had a good response so far, and we've still got almost 5 weeks to go. So if you want to come, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get our four-tape set on O.J. Simpson, it's still very apropos. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you really need to get that. If you're preparing, making preparations for the very difficult times that lie ahead, and you need information on long-term food storage, on a Berkey water filter, certainly on health products that you should have a good supply on, especially because the government's going to do everything they can to keep you from getting adequate health products, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get Joel Skousen's books on strategic relocation, or certainly on the secure home, on how to build a secure room in your home, we have these books as well. There are three of them, and they actually are among our best sellers of all things. We're carrying them because Joel had no means of distributing them, and of course, to our benefit and to his, if we are able to move them for him. Anyway, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. We hope you'll go to our website at radioliberty.com, and you can get the list of all the books we have, books you won't be able to get elsewhere, that will take you into the background of the secret societies that rule the world, books on the Illuminati. Nesta Webster's book on the world revolution, and Nesta Webster's book on secret societies and subversive movements. And of course, if you want to know about the secret society that controls the United States today, you want to get Professor Quigley's books. He was the leading historian of the last century. Both of his books were actively suppressed, one of them for 32 years, but we have them both now, Tragedy and Hope and the Anglo-American Establishment. That's Tragedy and Hope in the Anglo-American Establishment. If you'd like to hear the interview with Professor Quigley, that's in the Secret Government 4-tape set. And ladies and gentlemen, we really do have a secret government today. So again, the telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival, because this is a spiritual battle. But please pray for Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Ian Fletcher. And Ian, of course, has written a wonderful book entitled Free Trade Doesn't Work. As you look at America today, you find that so much of our manufacturing is moving overseas. In fact, there seems to be an organized effort to shift our steel manufacturing primarily overseas. We are doing a lot of major construction here on the Bay Bridge and in Oakland, and they're working very hard, of course, to develop all the various component parts for the Bay Bridge in Oakland, between Oakland and San Francisco, and they're building those products in China. And they're shipping them over the components for the bridge in the San Francisco Bay here. And then, of course, we're moving our textile industry out. We've moved that pretty well out of the country, the electronic industry, the automotive industry, the agricultural. They're doing everything they can to destroy the agriculture there in the Central Valley of California. We have 12.5% unemployment in California. A great deal of it is due to free trade. And the agenda that seems to be to actively transfer America's productive capacity to other countries. Well, Ian Fletcher has written a fascinating book, and we're going to ask him to talk to you a little bit about why free trade doesn't work. Ian, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on your show. You put on a good show, Doctor.
Well, thank you. Well, we put on a good show when we have good guests, and we put on a bad show when we have bad guests. We've had Ian on before, but I think his message is important, and I've asked him to come on. So, once again, why don't you tell our listeners why free trade doesn't work?
Well, I talk about that in my book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, which is available on Amazon.com. And basically, free trade never has worked. It's not this country's tradition. It's not what this country was founded on. If you have a $10 bill in your wallet, you pull it out and you look at the guy on the $10 bill. That's Alexander Hamilton. He was the economist among the founding fathers, and he was the intellectual father of American capitalism, and it's thanks to him that for most of American history, we had a tariff-protected economy. We did not have free trade. And on the basis of that, the United States went from being an agricultural backwater on the fringes of civilization to being the greatest industrial power the world had ever seen. Now, why is free trade such a problem for us today? Well, one of the big problems with free trade is you got to put quotation marks about that word free. Because in point of fact, when we say that America has free trade, and when I say that free trade doesn't work, I mean free trade on America's part. It is not free in the other direction. The other major economic powers of the world love to export to the United States, but they do not accept American imports in anything like the same quantities.
But of course, you know, it is totally illogical that our leaders would allow the other countries to take an unfair advantage on us, that they to subsidize their products in one way or another, to actually limit the introduction of our cars, our products into their country. So the other side, we allow them to discriminate against us, and we don't discriminate against them, and that really isn't logical. If our leaders wanted a strong and vibrant American economy, you would think that they would certainly insist that the other countries allow our products into their country without all these barriers being put up or subterfuges, wouldn't you?
You would indeed. The reality is that the game that is played in international economics is a very old game that goes back...
Hold that thought. Go right ahead, Ian.
Are we on the air, Doctor?
We are on the air.
Very good. I was just confused by the music.
Don't let that confuse you. Basically, we have all sorts of networks and various radio stations, and certainly the radio stations. We're here when we're talking after the music, and then, of course, we'll have music again in another 2.5 minutes, and we'll bring more radio stations on. But this is a complex situation, but go right ahead.
Anyhow, as I was saying, the reality is that the game being played in international trade is a very old one. It goes back 400 years, back to the dawn of capitalism, not long after Columbus and his sailing ships. Because you've got to understand that international trade is nothing new. It's been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's called mercantilism. What mercantilism is it's a view of international trade in which nations exist in a state of rivalry. And there are all sorts of tricks associated with mercantilism by which one nation can grab a competitive advantage in the world market. For example, we have currency manipulation, which is currently a big topic in the news, and there's some talk. Recently, the House Ways and Means Committee was debating whether to bring a suit against Chinese currency manipulation before the World Trade Organization. Which won't do any good, but at least they're starting to wake up in Washington to the fact that this is going on. Now, China is unfortunately only the most blatant example of this. For example, our good friends the Germans also manipulate their currency because they don't have the Deutschmark anymore, they have the Euro. Now, the Euro is a blended currency made up of all these different countries from Germany to Greece and Italy and Spain. And because you have one currency for a whole host of disparate national economies, you have a currency which is much too strong for the weaker economies, which is why Greece went broke, and much too weak for the stronger economies like Germany, which means that they've manipulated their currency to make it artificially cheap, and that's why their exports are booming. Now, Germany's coming out of recession now, and we're not. And part of the reason for that is that German exports are booming, so they're creating jobs through exports when we're losing jobs through imports.
And, of course, basically, as long as you don't have anything behind our currencies, all currencies are fiat currencies, any country can lower their currency to increase their exports, make their imports more expensive, but that gives them a trade advantage, which is exactly what the Chinese have with the United States and other countries. They manipulate keep their value of the currency low, so they have an advantage. They have the greatest trade surplus any nation has ever had.
That's true.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sydney on the end was just talking about what has happened. Sydney, nations lower the value of their currency to make their goods more competitive on the international markets. China has kept their yuan low. It's kept it pegged to the dollar. The dollar goes down, the yuan goes down. And that way, of course, their products are much cheaper than ours. So they have, because of this unfair trade advantage, they have accumulated something like $2.5 trillion, or $2.6 trillion in trade surplus, the greatest surplus any nation has ever had. And America is now the greatest debtor nation, not only as far as its domestic, but its relationship to other nations, the greatest debtor nation the world has ever seen. But go right ahead.
As I was saying, this is a very old game. And the sad part of it is that this is not something that happens because China has overpowered or outsmarted the United States. It is something that happens because we've allowed it to happen. You can look back at financial history and see very small nations, like small countries like Switzerland, for example, when their currency was being manipulated by various currents in the international economy, and they said, no, we're not going to let that happen. They put their foot down. It's a very small country. They were able to do it. If we were to stop and say we're not going to allow currencies to be manipulated against us, because you got to remember, when someone manipulates the value of their currency in dollars, it's our currency that's being manipulated as well as theirs. If we were to make the decision not to allow this, it would be over in 2 weeks. Only happening because our government is letting it happen.
Well, I can remember 20 years ago hearing how the Japanese had all sorts of barriers to American vehicles going into Japan, but we had no barriers to Japanese vehicles coming in here. And it was the same thing with almost everything going into Japan. We allowed them intentionally to set up those barriers, basically to damage America's exports and to facilitate Japanese imports. It's almost as if there are people in Washington, D.C. who wanted to favor Japan over their own country.
Well, the sad fact is that that's true, because multinational corporations find it very profitable to produce overseas, particularly in places like China, where the average wage is under $1 an hour, and then bring those goods back into the United States. That's reason number one, pure special interest corruption. The more subtle reason is the corruption of the economics profession, where a great many economists who really ought to know better are going along with this and telling everybody that free trade is best and supporting this myth that is bandied about in Washington. And one of the things I discovered when I wrote my book is that the reasons why free trade is not best are no secret. They are not exotic. They are not that difficult to figure out. And I hope if anybody buys my book on Amazon.com, it's called Free Trade Doesn't Work. The reasons why free trade is bad are well within the grasp of any reasonably intelligent, concerned citizen who's willing to make the issue to think these things through. They're certainly within the grasp of PhD economists. And yet, the profession has become corrupted, intellectually corrupted and misguided. And as a result, economists have been handing out a blank check for these terrible free trade policies for years now.
But I can, of course, they have a lot of help from the media, and of course, the media, you know, I heard Leslie Stahl one time on 60 Minutes, one session, she's interviewing some fellow from the steel industry, and he's just saying that other countries are giving, you know, subsidies and financing their steel industry, and he thinks we ought to have tariffs or something to protect our steel industry, or subsidies or something, so we can compete evenly with these other countries. And Leslie Stahl looked at this man with this look of horror and disdain on her face and said, "You are a protectionist." And he began to stammer, and he didn't know quite what to say. And that's what they do. When you talk about, you know, trying to have an open playing field, or certainly trying to protect American industry, you become a protectionist. And then they trot out the Smoot-Hawley Act, and they said, why, that's what created the Depression. Smoot-Hawley created the Depression, and you want to bring in the Smoot-Hawley and plunge us into a recession? Well, of course, I think we're already in a recession or depression, but be that as it may, you know, Sydney, the media goes right along with this idea of demeaning and attacking and vilifying anybody who talks about free trade, that the fact that free trade doesn't work.
Sure. The man you're talking about is a man called Dan DiMicco. He's the CEO of Nucor Steel, which is the largest steel maker in the United States. And he's an acquaintance of mine. He gave me a nice little blurb on the book, and I've watched that interview. And
really, I mean, you are a protectionist. I mean, she just sort of spit out those words with tremendous venom. You know, you are a protectionist.
Well, so was George Washington. So was Abraham Lincoln. So was Roosevelt. So were most of the great names from American history. The fact is, you can gin up whatever argument you want about how protectionism is supposed to be economically disastrous. The fact is that the United States, when it was an openly protectionist economy, went from being a third world country, which is what this country was in 1776, to being the greatest industrial superpower in the history of the world. Economic history just does not support this condemnation of protectionism. And if anybody wants to talk about the myth that the so-called Smoot-Hawley tariff of 1930 supposedly caused the Depression. Now, that's a complicated question, and I unpack that a bit in Chapter 6 of my book. All I can tell you briefly on the radio is that no serious economist actually believes that. Not even ultra-right-wing free market people like Milton Friedman. He's dead now, but for years and years he was the dean of all the ultra-free market economists. I have him in print saying, no, depression's basically nothing to do with that. Or the liberal guys like Paul Krugman, who, I don't know what you think of him, until very recently he was a free trader, pretty much, and he said, you know, I believe in free trade, but this stuff about Smoot-Hawley is just ridiculous. That's just a myth. I mean, I can go into details on it, but it's probably not appropriate for a radio program.
Well, maybe sometime we can do that. But see, the problem is that how can you have a laborer in America making $20, $30, $40 an hour with benefits compete with a laborer in China making a dollar an hour? I mean, this just doesn't work. In fact, there's very, very few jobs here in the United States outside of perhaps over there in Silicon Valley. There are very few jobs in the United States, you know, where our laborers, our producers, can not be undercut by people in other countries. And if we don't have tariffs, if we don't have some means of protecting our industries, why, we're going to lose whatever we have. Certainly, would you like to discuss a little bit about Professor Alan Blinder? He's a very prominent professor who's been pushing this free trade garbage for years, until one day he woke up and had an epiphany, and he suddenly said, you know, we could lose another 40 million jobs.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there's no way you can expect American workers to compete with virtual slave labor in countries like China, and even in countries that are politically free countries. Like, India is a democracy. It's not a dictatorship like China, but the people are still desperately, desperately poor. So You can't compete with that. You mentioned Alan Blinder. Sure, he's one of President Obama's chief economic advisors, and he wrote in an article that came out a couple years ago now that offshoring, that is when they move things like call centers for when you call up an 800 number or the people who process your insurance claim or all these kind of clerical white-collar jobs. He said that thanks to offshoring, partly due to the internet and cheap long-distance phone service, but he said that offshoring was probably going to affect up to 40 million American jobs in the long run. Now, I don't know if we can afford to sacrifice that many jobs because...
Well, look at our economy now. How many more jobs can we lose and still have a viable society? I mean, certainly, I mean, we've got a phenomenal level of unemployment. I don't think the Bureau of Labor Statistics is being objective at all. And they talk about U2 unemployment, they ignore U6 unemployment, and then they put in a birth-death ratio to make the statistics look better and to certainly fulfill that old saying, you know, figures don't lie, but liars can sure figure.
Well, you know, the unemployment figures are interesting because this is one of the cases in which the government not quite lies, but they certainly spin the facts, because they actually release the real unemployment figures in addition to the kind of prettied up figures that they release. Now, the way it works, if you actually go talk to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you go on their website, and if you're listening, you can look this up, is there's not actually one unemployment figure for the country. There are six different unemployment figures. They're called U1, U2, U3, U4, U5, and U6. And they're all slightly more pessimistic definitions of what unemployment is. Now, the unemployment figure that's usually quoted in the media is U3, which, among other things, excludes everybody who's not looking for a job anymore. Now, the theory is that when you call someone unemployed, it doesn't just mean that they don't have a job. It means they don't have a job and they want a job. So that's the excuse for excluding people. Now, the problem is that this excludes everybody who desperately wants a job, but they're not looking anymore because they've given up, because they don't think they're going to find one. If you look at figures for unemployment that include people that have given up, the unemployment rate in this country is more like 16% than 12%. And among certain segments of the population, among the young, the poor, the black, and so on and so forth, it's well over 20% now. And those are depression levels in certain communities, I'm afraid. So things are, as you say, much worse than people think.
Well, our telephone number, I guess this evening, of course, is Ian Fletcher. His book is Free Trade Doesn't Work. And people have to understand that we got a real problem in America. We are certainly see an economy that's contracting. But you certainly would like, of course, to open up our factories again. But you're not going to open up your textile factories. You're not going to open up your electronic factories. Most of the electronic gadgets we get are manufactured overseas. Even our washing machines and dryers and things like that, they're all made down in Mexico by Westinghouse. But Westinghouse is no longer an American corporation. More and more of our corporations are being bought up by foreigners. More and more of our products are being made overseas. How much further can we go and still survive as a free society? Well, Ian, I'm going to let you go ahead and just talk about the thing.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 3:16 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
In the process, they have to destroy the economies here, certainly the textile industry, the steel industry, the automotive industry, and at least partially the electronic industry, the agricultural industry. They're all leaving America.
Well, it's no secret that when the owners of capital can move capital around the world, and they can make a profit wherever their money is invested, but a lot of them are just not that interested anymore as to how well the United States does because their money is elsewhere, so their hearts are elsewhere. It's not much more complicated than that in some cases, I'm afraid.
And basically, of course, then they shift their production over to China because they're going to make more money over there. But then we actually, of course, we encourage that American policy. It says that if you manufacture your goods in China, you don't have to pay American corporate taxes, unless you bring the money back here. So that we, in some respects, the government policies are favoring people who are moving their businesses, their production facilities offshore, and harming the working people here in America. That doesn't make sense.
Oh, you bet. And I don't know if you recall Ross Perot in 1992 debating with Al Gore, talking about the giant sucking sound of jobs going to Mexico if we signed NAFTA. Now, I thought at the time that Perot was a bit of a kooky billionaire, and I think that may still be true, but to be quite honest, the man has been vindicated. Let me just read you a quote from my book about that. I wrote, "Eccentric billionaire and 1992 presidential candidate H. Ross Perot was roundly mocked for predicting a giant sucking sound of jobs going to Mexico if NAFTA passed. But he has been vindicated. The Department of Labor has estimated that NAFTA cost America 525,000 jobs between 1994 and 2002. According to the More Aggressive Economic Policy Institute, a think tank funded by organized labor, those guys are my friends, by the way, they wrote, NAFTA has eliminated some 766,000 job opportunities, primarily for non-college-educated workers in manufacturing. Contrary to what the American promoters of NAFTA promised U.S. workers, the agreement did not result in an increased trade surplus with Mexico, but the reverse. As manufacturing jobs disappeared, workers were downscaled to lower-paying, less secure services jobs. Within manufacturing, the threat of employers to move production to Mexico proved a powerful weapon for undercutting workers' bargaining power."
And I think that is really so true. I mean, they promised us, we've got all these Mexicans down there, and they're going to be buying our products. We're going to be opening new factories to produce the products in New Mexico that they will consume in Mexico. Well, what really happened was they opened new factories in Mexico, and people here in America, instead of getting more jobs, they lost jobs. Did you say there were over almost 750,000 people lost their jobs? How many people lost their jobs?
That's what the union people say. I think that's a reasonable estimate.
All right, fine. Of course, I certainly agree with the unions. I mean, they're against this, because, of course, it's destroying the union base here. And believe me, I sometimes don't always agree with the unions, but we need the unions. We need a balance between the corporations and their employees. Otherwise, of course, we would have slave labor wages here with no benefits at all. So the unions have done, whether we want to admit it or not, they've done and served a very important part in creating the society we have today.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm well aware that there's any number of problems with trade unions. I'm not naive about that. But the fact is that if you don't have unions, there is no organization that stands up for the economic interests of the ordinary working man. There just isn't. I mean, there's a ton of organizations fighting for corporate America every which way. There's got to be somebody balancing that, and that's what we got.
Well, Sydney, but what is going? Are they really not being very effective at the present time? Because it seems that the globalists are just shipping more and more of our jobs overseas, and we're seeing more and more people losing their employment, more and more people are losing their homes. We're seeing small businesses closing down. Why? Because they don't have any customers. They don't have any customers because so many people have laid off. And so many people's wealth, primary source of wealth, was their home. And many of those homes are actually underwater today. Where is it all going to end up, Ian?
I think we're headed for a crisis at least as big as the financial crisis of 2008.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a couple of moments. Our guest this evening is Ian Fletcher. If you have any questions, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Ian's book, Free Trade Doesn't Work. We carry it. We think it's a great book. We don't carry many books, but we think that's important. This is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Ian Fletcher, and of course Ian Fletcher is basically advocating that we need a protectionist society. We need tariffs to protect our society, and we need to look after our own, certainly our own industry. Now, I agree with this basic process and concept, but of course some people will point out that sometimes tariffs certainly favor certain industries over other industries, and of course they can be used to favor one group over another. How do you respond to that?
Well, I talk about that problem in Chapter 11 of my book, Free Trade Doesn't Work. I say best solution I can think of is just have a flat tariff. So if you had, say, tariff of 25 or 30% on all imports to the United States, then you take all the political mischief out of the picture, because there's no option of some corporation sending its lobbyists to Washington and trying to pay off the politicians to impose a higher tariff on the goods that they sell than are imposed on other products. So if you had a flat tariff, you could certainly take the political mischief out of the picture.
And I think you're absolutely right. The difficulty is, of course, you have everybody looking after their own interests, which is what's really wrong with the process we have today, when you have, at one time, of course, the senators were supposed to represent the interests of the states. But then they said, oh, no, we want more democracy. So they passed the 17th Amendment. Well, they really didn't pass it, because a gentleman I know checked all the states and found out it never really passed. But that didn't matter. Once, of course, you had the direct election of the senators, well, then, of course, you had the final. The senators' money could buy, because of course they wanted to get reelected. They needed money, and of course, under one way or another, why? Of course, when somebody gives you, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars by one subterfuge or another, why? Of course, you have at least some obligation to those individuals. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest is Ian Fletcher. His book, Free trade doesn't work. And all you need to do is pick up the business page any day today, and you know, free trade really isn't working very well. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess Ian Fletcher has book Free Trade Doesn't Work. If you have a question for Ian, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. This is a vitally important subject. Ian's basic theme is we need tariffs. I made the point when we were off air there, or when we were talking with a limited audience, that the fact that various people would use the tariffs to their advantage, and Ian's response was, what you need is a universal tariff. It doesn't change from industry to industry. It would be a 25-30% tariff. Yes, it would raise the prices, but at least we'd have business here in America. Well, Ian, you have a website. Would you like to tell people how to get to that website?
I have a website at www.freetradedoesn'twork.com, and that's got some information about my book. It's got a little video of me talking about the book on C-SPAN, so I think folks might find that interesting.
And I think it's a very, very important subject. In fact, we'd had Ian on before, and we really enjoyed it. We carry his book. But, of course, he had sent me an email recently. One of the major book distributors would not carry their book in their stores. And did you get any sort of response from them after you had people call?
That was Barnes & Noble. I'm still talking to them. They haven't told me yet whether they're going to carry my book in their stores. It's on the Amazon.com website, so there's no difficulty obtaining it. I just would have liked for it to be in the retail stores so people can browse it. Among other things, when people browse the book, they find out it's not just dry as dust economics.
No, it's really a very, very readable book, and we really enjoyed it. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you have a question or comment, this is an important subject. This is one of the keys to addressing the current economic decline of America. Herman is calling us from Carmel. Hi, Herman. How are you doing?
Very well. Last week, it was announced that China, which has quietly cornered the market on rare metals and earths, is now refusing shipment of these items to certain countries, and they're being very difficult about it. I'm wondering when China will use its newfound economic might to throw its weight around, and why our leaders seem to be blind to this coming threat.
Okay. I know the story you're talking about. What rare earths are, for those listeners who've never heard of them, is they are exotic minerals that you need above all to make powerful magnets. Now, why are magnets important? Because they go into all sorts of things, like a Sony Walkman or an iPod, an iPhone, those tiny little headphones you put in your ear. The reason you can have a headphone that small that works the way you couldn't when we were growing up, headphones with these big bulky things, is because if you have a super strong magnet, you can make a super powerful speaker. Also, if you want to have an electric car, or if you just want to have an efficient starter motor for a regular car, or any electrically powered appliance, to make a small, efficient electric motor, you need these very powerful magnets. So rare earths are these exotic minerals, which with names like praseodymium and so forth, they go into magnets. That's what this is about. Now, for various reasons, China is the geographic origin where a lot of this stuff is dug up, and they've also, by diligent effort through the manipulation of the government and so forth, established themselves as the only place in the world where you can refine these metals to the incredibly high levels of purity, like 99.999999% that you need in order to make these metals do what they're supposed to do. And important fact, the whole world is now annoyed at them, including the Europeans and the Japanese, because they're trying to get their claws on a quasi-monopolistic control of this commodity. So that's the story you're talking about. in terms of whether they're going to use this at some point to, quote, take over the world or something like that, there's no question that the Chinese are getting more and more aggressive about the use of their economic power as they build up their industrial might. Personally, I don't think they have a snowball's chance of taking over the world because the rest of the world is mostly wise to this game. The United States and maybe Great Britain are the only countries that are really subject to this free trade delusion. The continental Europeans, the Germans, the French, the Swiss, the Swedes, they know what's going on. They understand mercantilism. They understand government intervention into industrial policy. They invented a lot of this stuff 100, 200 years ago. You bet they know how it works. The Japanese certainly know how it works. The Chinese learned most of these tricks from Japan when the Japanese talked them out of communism. I mean, that's largely what happened. So what the Chinese are doing could do us a lot of damage, but they're not going to be able to take over the world with this nonsense, no.
All right, Herman, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
No, do they have a some sort of corner on lithium? Because lithium is very, very important as far as the batteries of these high-powered batteries are concerned.
Lithium is a little bit different. Lithium is not a particularly exotic mineral. You can dig it up just about anywhere. So, yeah, there's no question, for example, that battery technology, the U.S. is lagging in battery technology. The batteries for the new GM Volt, for example, the electric car, they're going to be made in Korea because there was no American company that actually had the ability to produce those in the U.S. That's what happens when you deplete and run down your industrial base. You don't just lose the ability to produce things today. You lose the ability to possess the industries of the future because you don't have the skills and the plant and the technology and the know-how to do these things. That's why it's so dangerous to allow your manufacturing industry to be run down, because manufacturing is not going away. It's not obsolete. There's nothing primitive about the kind of electric cars that the world is probably going to have to build over the next 20, 30 years.
All right, well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, but as far as buying an electric car in the United States, although they're putting in the smart meters all over California, really all over the country, and the purpose of the smart meter is basically to raise the cost of electricity. They say, you know, we're doing this because we want to decrease emissions. Well, why putting in a smart meter? Well, decrease emissions because they're going to charge you so much more for electricity if you're using it at noontime, and they say it'll be cheaper at nighttime. But boy, you better never get an electric car and plug it in at noontime because you want to go downtown someplace because it'll cost you a fortune. They're really driving up the cost of electricity, and that is going to impact on a lot of these smart people who are buying electric cars today. Well, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY-464-8295. They tell you it doesn't cost you much of anything for electricity. Well, ladies and gentlemen, they got a different plan, but that's another subject for another time. Well, Sydney, as you present your appeal for Sydney a protectionist society, which of course I agree with, what sort of response are you getting, Sydney? It would appear that your message has only appealed to a very small number of people.
Well, it's very interesting. Among the ordinary citizenry of this country, I would say that a third of the country agrees with me, about another third is willing to listen, and only a third are vehemently in opposition. In terms of the elite, the people who call shots in this country, what I find fascinating is although 90% of them are still free traders, there are some very smart, very powerful, very important people in this country who are waking up. For example, I have a nice letter above my desk framed from a man called Jeffrey Immelt, who's the CEO of General Electric, which is the largest industrial company in the United States. And he kind of understates his case, and he's polite, and he can't stick his neck out too far. But it's absolutely clear from his public statements that he understands the mess America is in. He said, for example, that America really should go back to having about 20% of our GDP being accounted for by manufacturing rather than the 10% that it is now. Now, that's a very radical statement to make, particularly when it's coming from a Fortune 500 CEO. It's someone who cannot be ignored. So that's what keeps me warm at night when I sometimes wonder and I get lonely with all the opposition I face. There are some very powerful, very smart people out there who are gradually waking up on this stuff. And that's one of the reasons I'm confident that I'm right about this.
And it was very interesting that just this last week they talked about the last plant closed, the last General Electric plant that produces light bulbs in the United States. The lights are going out. For in the future, all of the light bulbs, or just about all of them, will be produced in China. They'll be fluorescent. And the government, in its wisdom, Congress, in its wisdom, has outlawed the incandescent light bulb to replace with a fluorescent light bulb, which costs more and lasts about half as long. But that's all right. You can't dispose of them because, of course, they have mercury in them, and they're all going to be produced in China. I wonder why Congress did that. Was that to strengthen our economy? Is that because we're really going to save so much electricity, or is there another agenda? But certainly, I'm sure China is really very pleased they're going to have an opportunity to produce all those fluorescent light bulbs.
In terms of a larger agenda, I can't tell you whether there's some sort of conspiracy going on. I read those websites. I'm aware that some people think there's a conspiracy to create a world government or something like that. I don't know. If you have evidence that there is, then there is. But what I can tell you is the people in power don't need a global conspiracy to ruin this country's economy. They are quite capable of doing it without such a thing. So even if all those speculations are false, this country is very seriously on the wrong track. But the silver lining is that I do believe that there is a crisis coming. I think that the American trade deficit alone, which is the difference between our imports and our exports, which is huge. We've been running on MasterCard for three decades now, basically. We've been importing more than we export, and we pay for it by selling off our existing assets to foreigners, our real estate, our stocks and bonds and so forth, and by going into debt to foreign nations from Beijing to Berlin. That cannot go on forever because although you can produce goods forever, you can't go into debt and sell off your assets forever. And I think that within 5 years, there's going to be a crisis, there's going to be a shock to the system on a scale comparable to the financial crisis of 2008. It could take the form, for example, of a collapse in the international value of the dollar. And then when this crisis comes, it's going to put an end to a lot of this nonsense. I mean, Wall Street has been, you know, has had its leash tugged pretty hard over the 2008 crisis. And this gives me hope that there will be a crisis which discredits the mistakes that are currently being made by this country's government.
Well, I'm sure there's going to be a crisis, and I hope that it will last, won't be before 5 years. We're just going to have to wait and see. But, you know, certainly we've lost so much of our industry. We've lost it, not only having it, moved to other countries, but even many of the domestic corporations have been bought up. I did a talk about 5 years ago, and at that time we analyzed, American corporations, about 25 of them, were owned by foreign companies, by foreign corporations. And I'm sure this is far more now. I know the Chinese are coming over here, and they're buying up. I know they've gone to Canada. They've invested heavily in the tar sands there, and they're coming in America and buying up shopping centers and things like that because they've got all this money, and they've got it because of the massive trade deficits. And certainly you can't keep simply shipping your money out of the country indefinitely, and I think that we're headed for a terrible awakening. And, of course, at that time, you're going to be probably looked on as a prophet, but I think there's going to be an awful lot of suffering. And as the price of the value of the dollar goes down, I think that there's so many people who've spent their whole life working to amass a fortune or amass money so they can have it to live on when they retire are going to be rudely awakened and find that their money is worth really very little. In fact, today, if you have $500,000 and you have it invested in the savings bank, you know, you get 1%, you get $5,000 a year. You can't live on that. And of course, if you got, you know, suddenly if you even got 2%, why, of course, you got $10,000 a year, but you can't live on that. And what's happening is these low interest rates are going to have a profound impact upon the people who want to retire. They've got money in the pension fund, but if they decrease the value of our currency, they're not going to have any money to live on. They're going to, because when you destroy the value of the currency, it means that the purchasing power is down. I'm really concerned that an awful lot of people who looking forward to retirement are going to be impoverished. What are your thoughts?
That is definitely a possibility. I mean, there's no question about the fact that this country has been digging a hole for itself for a very long time and sticking its head in the sand when we were warned about the mistakes that we were making. And I'm hoping, I mean, I wrote my book in part to help prepare people so that they know what to do when the crisis comes, because I don't want people to panic. I want people to know what the problem was, why it happened, and then calmly work our way through to a solution. I think that's possible. I still hold out the hope that we can solve our problems. And one just has to be patient and keep one's eyes firmly fixed on the facts.
But because the foundation of a society is the financial stability, the monetary system. And we have a very shaky monetary system. You undermine that monetary system, you undermine the life savings of the vast majority of the American people. That is my concern. And of course, you know, younger, why, maybe you can recover. When you're older, there's no way to recover. We have a Social Security system that's bankrupt. We have a Medicare system that's bankrupt. We have an FDIC that's bankrupt. We have a Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae that are bankrupt, the FHA, suddenly they're all dependent upon the government, and they're backed by the full faith and credit of the American government. The trouble is that the government has very little credit. It's having to borrow money every day. I don't think you can keep this going indefinitely, can you?
No, there's no question that Uncle Sam cannot continue to borrow money at the rate that our government has been borrowing. And the reality is that 75% of American government spending is on four things: war, pensions, medicine, and debt. So these things are going to have to be cut, and taxes are probably going to have to go up unless people will consent to extremely severe cuts. Now, those are realities that neither side in Washington wants to hear about. Democrats don't want to hear that spending will be cut. Republicans don't want to hear taxes are going to go up. That's probably what's going to have to happen.
But if you raise the taxes, won't you strangle the recovery?
That is indeed a threat, which is why I'm worried about it, sure.
So basically, it looks to me like they really don't have any very, very good alternatives. Certainly, if they cut the taxes, the deficits will grow. If they raise the taxes, the deficits will grow. And I see very little opportunity. Well, it's going to be very interesting to see how it develops. Certainly, Ian is a far better economist than I am. I'm a retired orthopedic surgeon, as you know. But I think you want to know what Ian thinks, and he certainly is. Would you say guardedly optimistic? Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah. Yes,
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up tonight's program at Radio Liberty. Well, Ian, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, and then we'll let you get to bed.
Well, I'd like to read you.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-Dry Guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.
Had a couple of 100,000 new jobs. Instead of we have 100,000 new jobs, we lost about 770,000 jobs. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they simply lied to the American people. So you have to realize, of course, when you hear a politician, you see a politician talking, you can tell when he's lying because his lips are moving, and they do lie to us consistently. But we have to be discerning and not listen to them. If you want to understand what this is really all about, you have to understand the globalist mentality. They want to transfer our wealth to other nations and impoverish the American people. And if you want the documentation, you need to read the Earth Charter. We have it here. You get it on the Internet, point 10A. It was written, certainly, by Mikhail Gorbachev, very strong, a multi-billionaire tied to the Rockefellers. Stephen Rockefeller, the nephew of David Rockefeller, the son of Nelson Rockefeller, and he simply, read it, it's an occult document. It talks about equitable distribution of wealth between nations. How do you get equitable distribution of wealth between nations? You lower the living standards of the American people, and you raise the living standards throughout the world. And if you read David Rockefeller's memoirs, and you really need to get that, you need to get Barry Goldwater's book, With No Apologies. We have second-hand copies. You need to get David Rockefeller's memoirs. We have new copies. On page 405, David Rockefeller talks about how some people think he's an internationalist and part of a secret cabal, and he says, you know, if that's what you think, I plead guilty, and I'm proud of it. I'm an internationalist. And then he goes on to talk about how the wonderful things they've been able to do by raising living standards without the world and bringing prosperity to America. And if we weren't involved, I mean, would all of these good things have happened, like raising living standards elsewhere and raising living standards in the United States? Now, we wrote that in 2002, but the same thing's going on today. They want to take credit for what they did in 2002. Fine. Give them credit for it. But, of course, the whole idea was to raise living standards elsewhere. But look what's happening in America today. And they intend to grind down our living standards and to impoverish the American people. And when you understand that, it all makes sense. Otherwise, none of it makes sense. Certainly, you need, of course, to read our pamphlets on the financial crisis. We have them. They're available through Radio Liberty. We have my talk on my pamphlet on the history of money. We have my pamphlet on the prophetic warning. It's Andrew Jackson's 1837 farewell address. You need to read it because what he said was absolutely true. We have a book called The Coming Battle. It was written in 1899 by Mr. Walther, who said the banks are going to come to take over control of the American government. Ladies and gentlemen, they control it today. You need to get the membership list of the Brotherhood of Darkness. We put it together, the membership list of the Committee of 30, the membership list of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission. Who is it who controls our government today? Well, there's only 87 members of the North American chapter of the Trilateral Commission, and there you'll find the CEO of Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and Jamie Dimon, who was CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, was a member of the Bank of America, certainly Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo. They all belong to the lower tier, the Council on Foreign Relations, but they're all in this together. They just don't want you to understand there is an elite group. David Rothkopf wrote a book. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, worked with Henry Kissinger. It's called The Superclass. He'll tell you that 6,000 people run our country. The book was written, of course, to defame the idea that the Trilateral Commission was of any significance. Well, of course, it is the invisible government. That's the reason they allowed that book out, was to distract from the Trilateral Commission. You need to get the DVD we have on the Trilateral Commission. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Certainly, if you hope you've made your reservations to come to our all-day conference on the 17th of October, and then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, Power Hour listeners. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for caring about your world. Thank you for joining us. It is 15 September 2010. You are wanted, you are needed, you are appreciated here at the Power Hour. And we do thank each and every one of you for joining us today, because there's a big world out there that needs to be changed. But you know what? It's happening. There is such an amazing difference that is occurring in the psyche of the American public. They are getting it, they're feeling it, they're knowing it, and they're about ready to say no to it. I really believe that with the development of the healthcare Obama disaster medical pill, bill, cut, slash, and radiation program, which is all it is, there's going to be massive not no, but heck no. You see, it is not a healthcare bill. It is an entitlement bill to give you all the high blood pressure drugs that you need so that you can go ahead and eat all the wrong foods that you choose to eat without reprisal. So that when you get cancer from eating all the hot dogs and nitrites in the foods and the sloppy etiquette, the sloppy processed meat that we eat, then they can give you the cut-slash-burn treatment. Well, that is, you'll be on a waiting list to get it. You may get it, depending on your age, depending on who you are. You may get the treatment if they choose to give it to you. So there is a change that is happening. There's also an attack that is going to be coming. People will respond to the abuse and the tyranny. They're going to. And they're making such a powerful difference right now that something like more than about 60% of the people don't think Obama has citizenship rights here to be president. That's huge. So when you take the birther issue, plus the 9/11 issue, plus the Gulf War veterans that are waking up, plus, you have a good percentage of people who are seeing, even though they may not be acting upon it just now, they're seeing what's happening. So it's up to us to continue speaking, continue talking about it. And today we will be dealing with one of those issues, and that is Codex Alimentarius. Lots of rumors out there about what's going to happen to your herbs, your supplements. Lots of rumors and very little real information. So we've asked John Hamill to join us from the International Health Federation to find out what is taking place in the area of Codex Alimentarius. Armin Bouchard, who will be joining us, a farmer who they told you cannot deliver milk, raw milk. You cannot give out raw milk.